Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, February 9th, 2013. My name is Marsha Mary Baker, and our topic for today is Mr. Barack Obama, eminently qualified to be removed from the office of the presidency. Now, we have two guests I'm glad to have with us today to discuss this. First, speaking to us by telephone from Boston, Rachel Brown. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you, Marcia.
And she is on the LaRouche Political Action Committee Policy Committee. Many of you see her every Monday on the every Monday show of the discussion among the policy committee members. But Rachel, I have to say before I introduce our next guest, I know thousands of people know you from facing down the person of Barney Frank 3 years ago. And I have to say also, I want to take advantage of you being on again, that when your governor of Massachusetts ignored Barney Frank trying to be senator, mm-hmm. and passed him up, we all thought of you. Thanks, Rachel, for at least keeping that one particular stinker at bay and out of Congress. But I'm glad to welcome here live in the studio with me Ed Spanis. Hi, Ed.
Good to be back.
And Ed, many of you will know, especially from EIR Online, his many writings concerning, in particular, the evil, unconstitutional activities of the White House, in particular the killer drone policy, which has become a hallmark now, where Ed will have a lot to say about that to bring us fill us in the next hour. But I want to say a couple things by way of introduction. But on the format of the show, I am well. Many of you who are listening live or soon to do will listen this weekend appreciate that Boston is in the heart of the storm and has some parts of it on the eastern Massachusetts have over 3 feet. Not just Connecticut has that, and in fact, the Saturday morning tides really meant there were evacuations on the coastline. So Rachel is kindly speaking to us from a location with no electricity, and we're going to appreciate her doing that so that we appreciate the battery on her mobile phone lasting. So we'll quickly get into things and start with Rachel. But what I want to say is just this about the topic we picked, that Obama's eminently qualified to be removed from office. It sounds generic, but you know, we even set that earlier in the week before the Thursday, that would be February 7th, hearings took place in the Senate. There were two Senate hearings, one on John Brennan, that who is Mr. Killer Drone himself, that he should be head of the CIA, and a great deal came out there, and a great deal came out in the Armed Services Committee about the complete character, this evil character of the entire White House executive. And so it was almost like testimony for what ought to be impeachment. So, but the one thing I want to say by way of introduction, these two Senate hearings, Ed can fill us in more about that, what I'm referring to. That was an expression of kind of more institutional activation now, even at this late time, but it is real, of against the what should not be going on at the White House, against the menace in the White House. In the judiciary, you already know, I think it was January 25, a federal court ruled against the unlawful White House recess appointments when the Senate wasn't there, or they were trying to evade the Senate. All this evasion, all of this secretiveness, all of this killer behavior, there are more individuals speaking out, more institutional opposition, and that so forth and so on, of the kind of royalist privilege that Obama is exerting. So that we're going to be discussing some of that, not from the point of view that will kind of save humanity. No, it's our role involved in bringing this about and bringing this to the point of actual successful action to make a shift in Washington, D.C. Institutionally, in fact, the United Nations Human Rights Council is now investigating the Obama White House for this killer drones policy. So let me just put it this way, Rachel. Mr. LaRouche, when he was briefed on these two Senate hearings I mentioned on Thursday night, he made some remarks that are issued as a statement on LaRouchePAC.com, and he said, "We've reached a moment of truth." And I'll quote him. He said, "I call on members of Congress to uphold their pledge to defend the Constitution. Only a thorough, open, and competent congressional inquiry into the Obama assassination policy and the Benghazi tragedy can get at the truth that the American people so richly deserve." And I assure you, Mr. LaRouche was not calling for a long-term study. He's saying we should, he's holding people now to the standard of the emergency in the country. We're at a moment of great potential, but a moment of great danger as well. So, Rachel, I thought if you wanted to open up by making any commenting on the situation, and then in the course of the hour, we'll also have Ed fill in on some of the need to know that'll be very important for people to have about this. Go ahead.
Yes, I can. I had been thinking about the question of classical culture and the need for that in a time like today. I guess one thing I'll say is that I think the most important thing is that people are able to look outside of our momentary conditions and be able to think about how it is so we can possibly achieve a different future. And also to have the courage and the inspiration to continue acting with that future in mind. Because in a situation like now, where there's been so many horrible things happening, and when Congress seems not to be listening, and it seems like that's your only way out of this situation, people can fall into a certain type of despair, and despair really is the idea that you're confined to your condition in the present, and since man is a forward-looking creature, that's an unhappy condition. But so that's why LaRouche has been pointing a lot to the role of classical culture and art, and saying that we have to get outside of thinking practically right now and instead start thinking artistically, thinking about how it is that we're going to create something that's new. And you are seeing, just to bring it back a little bit to the political situation, you are seeing a lot of developments based off of certain principles that are being acted on. The challenges to Obama that are happening from the courts and from certain individuals are acting as a manifestation of the Constitution, and the fact that the Constitution itself is not just a document or a set of rules like many other parliamentary structure, documents are, but it actually itself is a living principle. And so the recent action you had by the federal court of D.C. Or some of the actions by people like Walter Jones and Bruce Fein and others working for impeachment and challenging the president in Congress are acting on behalf of something that's bigger than their own condition, and they're acting for the future and for the past. But maybe Ed wants to go into some of the specifics of some of these breakthroughs.
Yes, good. That's fine. Maybe you want to just even inform people how things are held up with Brennan, the potential.
Right. Well, the two very significant developments with respect to the, our government is created as a government of separated powers, right? Where no one branch and certainly no individual can exercise exclusive or arbitrary power in the sense of a monarchy. And the two very significant developments in this respect were, first, as Rachel alluded to, and Marcia, the January 25th decision by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, holding that Obama's recess appointments of last year were unconstitutional. Now, it's not that often that a court will declare that an action by a president is in violation of the Constitution. We saw it with Bush in a number of respects around the detentions, Guantanamo and the detention policy. But the fact that they said that Obama has violated the U.S. Constitution, I mean, that in itself is impeachable per se. Secondly, you had the two hearings this week. The one that was most significant in this respect, in my view, was the confirmation hearing for Brennan, because this is the first hearing that Congress has held dealing with the subject of drones and the assassination of a U.S. citizen, even though that was formerly not the subject of it. The subject was the confirmation of Brennan.
Okay.
Since Brennan is the architect of this policy, it's the first time that Congress has gotten into this. I mean, here you have a president that claims the power to secretly assassinate a U.S. citizen and not even acknowledge it, not even admit it. They've never admitted doing it. I mean, they've referenced it and sort of, you know, off the record boasted about it, but they've never actually said that they did this, that they killed it. It wasn't just one, it was three citizens, U.S. citizens that have been killed in Yemen. It was Awlaki, Awlaki's son, and another fellow there who was also a U.S. citizen. So in the first case, you had the court, the judiciary branch, asserting its prerogative under the Constitution to hold that an act of the president was unconstitutional. And in the second, you had the Congress, really for the first time, reviewing a policy that many people came out right and said that this is in violation of the U.S. Constitution. So you have the other two branches finally standing up and taking some action, which in itself is only indicative of what can happen, where these things can lead, which are ultimately to the Supreme Court, because this was only a court of appeals, to the Supreme Court holding the president in violation of the Constitution and impeachment by the U.S. Congress. So that's, in my view, is the significance of these two events.
Well, let me throw in here two things, bearing on what you're saying. I think 11 senators last Monday, that would be the 5th of, or the 4th of February, did issue a letter. It was sent to the president, and I'll just quote from questioning the nomination of Brennan, but from the point of view of the White House hasn't explained why they're killing people. And it says, "Dear President Obama," it says various things, and it says, "As the Senate considers a number of nominees for senior national security positions, we ask that you ensure that Congress is provided with the secret legal opinions outlining your authority to authorize the killing of Americans in the course of counterterrorism operations." So it's just one more.
Right.
That was 4 days, then the hearing took place, and then more. So the...
And actually, the Benghazi hearing was also held. That was a condition placed by some senators on for the confirmation, or even a vote on the confirmation, of Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense. So that hearing as well was around the confirmation process, and they said until we have the Defense Department spokesman, as Dempsey and Panetta, come and testify in a hearing on what happened in Benghazi, we're not going to confirm Hagel as Secretary of Defense. So that also involved Congress using its powers to hold or begin to hold the president accountable.
Right, and even if they, let me say here, Ed or Rachel, you can comment on it or not. A friend of ours here was saying and looking at it, on the one hand, you could say the White House is dysfunctional in the sense that came up that it certainly isn't an executive worthy of this nation and the Constitution. It's just the opposite, and it doesn't. It came up at the Armed Services hearing on Thursday about the fact that On 9/11/2012, when the attacks on the Benghazi compound were taking place, only for a few minutes one time did the president meet with General Dempsey and meet with the commanders in charge and the head of the Defense Department, and never bothered to get back to them, never entertained.
Exactly.
So he was asleep at the switch is the best way to do it, or he was AWOL. That's what I mean.
Basketball game or something.
Yes, that's right, overnight, and then flying to Nevada the next day. But the other thing is, you could say that the White House is entirely functional for the reason that Obama was foisted on this country by the people who vetted him, and that includes an element of the neo-British Empire, the Tony Blair-type gang, who want to have war all the time. Tony Blair the other day called it a generational war. But let me ask you, Rachel, do you, in the course of talking to more people as compared with three or four years ago, do you feel are some people's, not just due to empirics, but due to a sense of the moment, their identities are getting bigger and they're able to grasp any of this?
Yeah, definitely. People really do want to hear bigger things being discussed. Actually, we get it from people a lot. They say things like, I don't want to hear another thing about Obama. Just tell me what you're doing. Yeah, so, I mean, and I've also heard reports that in Congress, I mean, you can talk about the first 9/11 cover-up without the congressional aide blinking an eye.
You know, okay.
Mm-hmm. And now our discussions of the role of the Saudis and the sponsorship of terrorist groups in Congress is a question that we're, you know, meeting with people on. But yeah, definitely conceptions that are out of the ordinary are really the only thing that'll get to someone right now. Telling them something about what's going on is not going to move them because they know how bad it is. What they want to know is what's causing it and what can we do.
Right. I think you used the expression, I can't remember where, sometimes in the last month, the nation is saturated with evidence. But it's a question of conceptualizing, and people are hungry for that. Let me just, where do things stand, Ed, on, well, Ed, would you just fill in a minute for listeners, too? There's a certain attention about this now. Paris, La Figure, other international media and so forth. Can you say something about that? About the character of the White House.
Right. And this, it's really the first time that this has come into widespread sort of in the popular mind. I mean, people, I mean, I remember just a few months ago, you'd be in the field and people would come up defending Obama and you'd say, well, he's killed more people than 10 times more people than Bush has with drone strikes. They say, what? What are you talking about? I didn't know that. Mm-hmm. And, or, you know, just to pure denying that this has not been in the popular consciousness. And with what's happened over the past week, it has been. And I mean, there actually had, in certain respects, been more international attention to this than in the United States, but now it's all over the place. And the fact that you've got a U.S. president, I mean, there were three U.S. citizens killed, but keep in mind, there have been over 3,000 people killed in the drone strikes just in Pakistan and Yemen alone. That's not even counting Afghanistan.
Now, that's since Obama came in 2009, right?
Yes.
Right, so that's...
Because Bush did Bush... In Yemen, there was one drone strike under Bush. There's been about 60 under Obama.
Okay.
Which is, we should say, under Obama and Brennan, since Brennan is the, remember, he was the ambassador in Saudi Arabia, U.S. ambassador in Saudi Arabia.
That was in
the late 90s.
Okay.
It just came out this week that the drone base that's used for Yemen is in Saudi Arabia. That was set up, was negotiated by Brennan. The guy's very close to the Saudis. Also, you talk about the first 9/11, as Rachel was talking about. He's involved in the cover-up of that. Senator Bob Graham said that he went to Brennan about the 28 pages that had been suppressed, the deal with the Saudi
and the report.
Right. And Obama and Brennan are still suppressing that and keeping that covered up. So this guy is, he's Mr. Saudi. In the administration.
Right. So let me ask you more on that. Just let's make a point here of many people listening are very involved with their own congressmen, with senators, with state legislators. Where do things stand as far as, I understand the Senate comes back on Monday. The House comes in on Tuesday. Maybe only for a couple days, but what's the situation on these in this front?
Well, nowhere near what it should be. I mean, these guys seem to be away more than they're there. You know, it's pathetic in terms of the constitutional responsibility that Congress has. They'll be there for the State of the Union. You're probably going to see, you know, date night and stuff. These guys holding hands together. I mean, it's obscene.
What date is that?
Well, that's Tuesday. You have the votes coming up. I think the vote on Hagel is supposed to be this week. The Brennan vote, although this has not really been covered in any of the press, I watched the hearing and saw it. There were two senators that said they would hold up the Brennan hearing. One was Richard Burr, Republican of North Carolina, who said that until we get the documents on Benghazi, this confirmation can't go ahead. And the second was Ron Wyden, who said that we can't have a vote until we get all of the legal opinions.
He's a Democrat from Oregon.
He's a Democrat from Oregon. So you've got a Republican and a Democrat. And of course, in the Senate, if they want to, one person can hold it up. And this is, I mean, reporters are lazy or covering up or whatever, but this has not even been reported. But I saw it happen. Both of them said they would hold this up. So they have the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence has a closed hearing on Tuesday. And then at some point after that, they'll try and Feinstein certainly will try and schedule a vote. But the fact that Congress is finally showing a little bit of guts around this thing is useful, but by no means adequate to what they should be doing. As LaRouche said in the statement, they should be conducting a full investigation on these two questions, on Benghazi and on the drone killings. You know, Frank Wolf called for a select committee.
He's the Republican from Virginia.
Republican from this area in Northern Virginia. A select committee joint, which was the way 9/11 was handled. And no matter whether it's that or it's by the committees of jurisdiction, somebody needs to take this up. And likewise, on the question of the drone killing, as I say, it's not the question of a U.S. citizen is the most dramatic right now. But the broader question is the use of this, and its completely counterproductive nature strategically. You know, I wrote an article a few weeks ago saying that Obama is number one recruiter, is Al-Qaeda's number one recruiter.
Yeah, people, I'll recommend, look at the January 18 EIR, and you'll see that Ed's article, Drone Strikes as Strategic Folly, Obama's Al-Qaeda's number one recruiter, meaning the number of people affiliating them with...
Right. Some people will tell you that for every person you kill, you create 10 more enemies, especially in countries with a tribal culture, because, you know, they've got brothers, they've got cousins, you know, and somebody sees, you know, they're a member of their family or neighbor or the tribe blown to bits. I mean, these are not precise, clean killings. These are very high-powered explosives that come in and just, you know, incinerate and splatter anything in sight. And this does not... this is strategically, and I think that's in certainly in the mind of Tony Blair when he talks about generational warfare, a war for a generation. This is a recipe for perpetual war.
Yeah, let's identify for that for people again, and you can get news items on this if you want to have it on LaRouchePack.com, and also it's written up in LaRouchePub.com, But Tony Blair was interviewed by BBC last weekend, at least, and it appeared around the 3rd or 4th of February. And do you want to just say the kind of thing that he was saying is that, war is going to be prepared. It's a generational thing. It's not going to be over. Don't
right.
look for
not
it to
be over anytime quick.
Which was the whole backdrop to this, in fact, he's talking about Mali in Africa. He's talk, he said, don't go wobbly. He's sort of saying the White House should stay tough on this. Quote, this is Tony Blair, we are certainly talking about a generation. I think a better way to look at it is like the fight the West had over a long period of time with revolutionary communism. He's talking about Syria, he's talking about everyone. And of course, this is the brink of thermonuclear war. I mean, fooling around with, and so, I mean, I could, as I say, this is in the current EIR online, all the quotes from Tony Blair on that, but that brings us back to Obama's just the patsy of this, and that's why he was put in there, and that's why we're overdue in getting him out. So let me ask you something, Rachel, on this, because I think it was a month ago, and you had a statement on a video statement from Boston, and you reminded people, you used the expression, there are two fronts to this. Obama, that's what we've been talking about, which means the immediate danger of war, killing people, complete snubbing of anything, the Constitution included, and Glass-Steagall is the other front. Do you want to say something about what you were stressing there?
Sure. One thing is that these two crises are inseparable as one, the financial crisis and the dictatorship policy of Obama. The fact is that unless we reinstate Glass-Steagall, we will have a continued collapse of the entire financial system of the transatlantic, which is an intentional process of collapse and attrition. And that is the means by which you put into in a dictatorship, which Obama is now, you know, as everybody can see, going for since day one. And we established that at day one and since 2009, and we put out the mustache and we braved the crowds out on the street with that mustache before many people could see what the intention was of the Obama presidency. So we said it. We said Obama's going for dictatorship. It's the same thing as Hitler. With his C4 policy, with his healthcare policy to deny people of what they need, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, which is also what you're seeing in come out as the drone case. One senator from Maine, Angus King, brought that up. It's not just the Second Amendment, like a lot of people are talking about. What about the Fifth Amendment? You know, right to life and liberty. So that Obama is depriving citizens even of that. But so it's a full-on dictatorship, and it will go through as long as we have this process of financial collapse. You see the intention of it carried out in Europe right now, where the IMF, for example, admitted that they made a mistake in their calculations for their Greek policy. For their austerity calculation for Greece. They thought that for every dollar they cut from Greece's budget, you'd only have a minor contraction. I don't know. Even that is silly. But they thought it would just be a minor contraction. They found out it was 150% contraction of the productivity of Greece for every dollar they took out, which means it's a debt spiral. However, 1 week later, they enforced the same policy to continue after admitting that it's inherently a genocidal policy. So now you see the same thing that, being carried out in the United States as Obama says we have to make the cuts here, and that's the only way out of this mess. So unless we put through Glass-Steagall, that process will continue.
Right, and while you were saying that, I was thinking of another hearing this week. It was on the Army Corps of Engineers and their what kind of policy they were going to have on water. Well, since they don't have any resources, the whole thing was a little tricky. I mean, I'm ridiculing it, but it was another aspect of what's going on in the United States in this regard of just having this financial bailout death policy, you know, killer economic policy, is the pending budget cuts on an institution that has no resources anyway, like the Army Corps of Engineers. The senators kept asking, what happens if sequestration? What happens when you have a 9% across the board cut? So the spokeswoman, I think it's Jo Ellen Darcy, said, yes, we will cut flood control. Yes, we will cut dredging of the navigation channels and the waterways. Yes, we will cut. And there you are, Rachel, in the Northeast with 3 feet of snow flooding on the Massachusetts coast after you had what you had a year ago, and then last fall with, so it, the, as you once, the empirics could not be more obvious that this is insane. This, you have deaths now, and if you don't have your institutions, your Army Corps of Engineers, National Guard, and all of this, which we don't, then you're completely vulnerable, but it's because of your own policy, speaking of people not thinking ahead into the future. And in that regard, let me ask you again, because sequestration is one buzzword, another is fiscal cliff, another is debt ceiling. Do you want to say something about that, Rachel?
Yeah, we're going off the cliff now.
Okay, there you go.
I think that's the main point. You don't have to prove to people too much that we've destroyed any means of production. And I think that's the new buzzword we need to create, is physical production. And I know from a lot of words, a lot of discussions we've been having in Congress, and I went into the Boston City Council last week and had a very interesting response from some people there, also in the State House, that the fallacy of the monetarist system, as you're also bringing up, is becoming clear for many people too. So I think we have to replace these insane monetarist buzzwords with ones that actually will point to the real issue.
Yes, I had on my list, I wanted to ask you about that, and Ed may know things from Virginia and elsewhere in the country, but you said you were in the State House as well, and people, let me just mention, people listening should know we have action every day. There's a national organizer's call that compares notes on this every Thursday. But I think yesterday, on Friday, there was we were active in the Kentucky State Legislature. One of your colleagues, Bill Roberts, I think, on the policy committee for LPAC might have been there. We were active in Nevada. We were active in Montana. People should know that the Pennsylvania State Assembly has had a very senior lawmaker put in a resolution in support of the Glass-Steagall reinstatement, Return to Prudent Banking Act, H.R. 129. And that was already crossfired, the Pennsylvania one, out to some western states. So do you want to say more about Massachusetts or anywhere in New England or the country, Rachel?
The main thing I'll say about Massachusetts is that there really are two Massachusetts, and so pointing that out to people is useful. The fact that we actually began with a credit system, that's the best way to defeat the other influence on people of the vaulting going along with Wall Street and all of this kind of stuff. That people have a tendency to settle into a certain comfortable persona, even though they know you're right. That's something you'll get a lot in New England. And so just pointing out the fact that, like, this, that was not the origin of this area. Didn't you have, ancestors that were here, and many people do. That's a way that you can a lot of times draw the good side out of people. And this person in particular that responded, one person that responded more strongly in the Massachusetts State House, he was able to think about it from a bigger viewpoint, not just of the state, but he said, well, I understand what you're saying about Glass-Steagall. A lot of people don't think it's a state issue, but I'm going to do whatever I can to help, show people how this is the way out. But I do think that it is only a matter of time. I think the process is in motion. Obviously, nothing is set in stone, but we know that what we're doing is the only thing that'll work, and we are definitely getting more and more responses of people that are starting to see that.
Right. Do you want to say anything on that, Ed, in the sense of your constitutional, the points you were making about the Constitution, the separation of powers, but the character of this republic?
Well, I would look at the sort of the flip side of this, which is while you have Obama and company denying any due process to citizens, look at what's happened with the banks and the too big to jail. Right, they're not only too big to fail, they're too big to jail. Here you've got these guys cold with evidence, and they refuse to prosecute. They make these sweetheart deals. And Lanny Breuer, the Deputy Attorney General, and Holder have both said, well, we have to look at what would be the consequences, you know, if we were to shut down a big bank. You know, so these guys essentially have immunity from prosecution because of their size, the fact that this is part of the British City of London Wall Street axis, and they get let's put it, an abundance of due process, of a distorted kind of due process of saying we can't possibly prosecute you because it might damage the financial system. But on the other hand, if Obama wants to go out and kill you, he can do it in secret with no due process whatsoever.
Right. One footnote on this is there was the Justice Department has been playing footsie for several years with, for example, the rating agencies that over the years 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 that led up to this, that would be Standard & Poor's, Fitch, there are other famous ones. And these agencies, so a kind of a flim-flam lawsuit was filed by the Justice Department that these agencies rated were kind of doing a con job, would rate anything the way they wanted to in order to feed the big banks having collateralized debt obligations, home mortgages in Boston, you name it, right? So the emails have, many emails have come out from Standard & Poor's, as they did in 2001 from the Enron day traders out in California that deliberately made money off blackouts and made jokes about, oh, I hope your grandmother isn't, I'm glad she's stuck in the dark, I just made $5 million. So these emails said, we would rate anything. A cow could structure a deal and we would rate it. So I'm only adding some color to the, in fact, the very evil fact that you just mentioned, too big to jail. It's perfectly obvious. And Rachel, that's probably another thing that you have to have an action of the mind to become human again. But speaking of empirics, it's all over the place, right? People must grasp that, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Let me ask you another thing. And before the time is out, we can turn to Ed again if he has any, again, more to make sure that we know about it's momentum that has come out. You never know. It's almost Shakespearean, you could say, that there's a certain development in the real drama about the fact that the killer drones has come back on the White House. I mean, this practice, it shouldn't have been gone for 4 years. It shouldn't have been gone under Bush. It shouldn't, Tony Blair shouldn't be walking that, you know. But before we get back to that, the thing is, Rachel, with you on here, you've often made the point about it's a question of culture. People are impeded, they're impaired because of popular culture being so debilitating to humanity. But on the other hand, when there's a chance, when you have music, when people can relate to it, you see the people becoming human again. Now, you were at this conference January 26 in New York City, a lot of Northeastern. There were 300 people there. I saw you there. So do you want to, would you make this a point about the question of culture and what we're doing with music? Because you've been involved in this in Boston, in the Northeast for years.
Yes. And there is something inexplicable about working on classical music or listening to it. I think the essential aspect of it in culture is that it's you need something that can express what can't be expressed in words. The role of art, I think, is to express something that's timeless but can still be knowable, and to give it to you so that you can conceive of it as a one, and then therefore see yourself in something much bigger than your own immediate existence, and see yourself in something that is eternal. Because when you have an idea as a one, and I mentioned this on policy committee, but if you have a well-composed classical music piece or poem, it's not something that you can divide into words or parts, but the entire composition itself is a one. And so when you can look down on that, you can, in a sense, look down on yourself, and you can also see this process of development of mankind and see yourself in that. And that's what people really need right now and in general. You see that culture has an identical relationship in human history with the functioning of the society. And that when we lost the classical culture, our society also started to go downhill. We had some testimony to that in the conference, which was very, very powerful, which people can get on the Schiller Institute website. But just one example was a young woman working with a music teacher in New York who started a foundation called something like the Foundation to Revive Classical Culture. And she wanted to bring this to people that wouldn't usually experience classical culture, because usually it's just for rich people. That's one way they keep it from reaching everyone else. And so they invited students from the schools and their families to come into free concerts. One of them was organized at Carnegie Hall on Mother's Day. And Carnegie Hall was very nervous because they didn't know how you could, fill the theater on Mother's Day for classical music for, students. And they surprisingly did it. And they said that when they were organizing for it, the principals of the schools or the teachers she'd call, at first they would have a reaction like, no, I don't really think too many people will want to come, but I'll ask around. And they found that these people started calling her back and saying, can I get more tickets? Can I get more tickets? And they had an unbelievable response from people that, you'd think had never even heard classical music before. And so it does have a power to move minds and to give people a sense of something that is in everybody. So no matter what condition you're in, it's known to drive people, to inspire them. And that's what life is really about.
Oh, that's, yes, thank you very much. And therefore, when you think about that, it's so miserable to return to the, not miserable, you have a joy of doing what you have to do, and that brings us back to what you were saying about we must have Glass-Steagall, we must force this issue, and we are again faced, we have to act to get rid of Obama. So, Ed, you're saying, I mentioned people can look at the February 7th or 8th statement by Mr. LaRouche calling for a real, getting to the root of the, and revealing what's behind a real study by Congress on the conduct of the White House before and during the attacks on the Benghazi embassy where Christopher Stevens and other people died, and the conduct for 4 years of killing people through the drone policy, right? So what else do you want to say about that? Is it?
Well, this also speaks to the importance of busting up the two-party system. Because if you watch Congress, as I've done for the past, decades, but particularly the past 12 years, when Bush and Cheney were in power, the Democrats were all, high and mighty in principle and going after Bush and Cheney correctly, right, on the torture policy, the detention policy. But as soon as a Democrat comes in, they've got mud in their mouth. They're gagged. They won't say anything. And they don't even want to admit that the policy is going on. Dianne Feinstein is a particularly disgusting case of this.
She's the head of the Intelligence Committee.
She's the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And she, for the most part, on the hearing on Thursday, was being a lawyer for the administration.
Okay.
And she said, you know, as one example, well, I've been briefed, and the number of civilian casualties are in the single digits. People are just completely wrong when they say they're much higher than this. And, I mean, that's preposterous. Any number of studies, anybody who's gone in and talked to people in Pakistan, as a number of people have, you had the Stanford study, you had the Columbia, these are both studies done by their law schools, NYU University Law School.
Yeah, let me say here, look at EIR online. The February 1st EIR has a listing of has
right.
Several of these.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
And you know, in Pakistan, they do things that they call signature strikes, which is where you pick a group of people, you don't know who they are, but they look suspicious because they're young men driving a truck or having a meeting or something like that. They must be terrorists.
Whack. I think they use the name military age males.
Yeah, right. And they count any military age male is considered automatically to be a militant or a terrorist. So if they're killed, they're not civilians, they're terrorists. Feinstein, a reporter, asked her after the hearing, are you aware of how they count, that they consider any military age male to be a terrorist? And she didn't know that, right? Somebody else asked her, well, how is it when Bush was in power, you were very skeptical of the figures that they gave, with the briefings they gave you on detention and interrogation policy. You didn't believe what they told you, but now you believe every word that the Obama administration tells you. So it's this knee-jerk partisanship that we can't criticize the Democratic president. Now, obviously, Wyden and Durbin and others have broken from this, like around the letter that you mentioned, the 11 senators.
Yeah, should I?
But it's poisonous. It's poisonous, and we're never going to get restore some justice and accountability to the presidency, much less restore the Constitution, unless this reflexive two-party system reaction is broken up. And, you know, Mr. LaRouche has spoken of this many times, others have, but it's just, you know, totally obvious and evident when you watch a hearing like this.
Right, and I think you point to something, too. It's, we should know from the timing, you know, anyone listening, as I say, there's also an organizer's call, but now is the time where one call, your action can make a difference. This thing is at a new level.
Absolutely.
Of potentiality. I just happen to have some of the other Democrats that issued this letter,
right,
complaining to the White House. Al Franken from the Midwest, Patrick Leahy, a senior Democrat from Vermont, Dick Durbin from Illinois.
It's the number two Democrat in the Senate.
Right. And Ron Wyden, we said, from Oregon. So they joined some of the senior Republicans, not some of the, Chuck Grassley from Iowa has been there a very long time, Susan Collins from Maine a long time. So this doesn't mean they'll do it. It means the potential is there,
right,
if we interject into it.
Right, and I mean, one thing that I think it was Angus King said to Brennan, he says, you know, we, that is referring to the intelligence committees in both the House and Senate, we're the only people watching you, right? I mean, institutionally, in terms of our scheme of government, these intelligence committees are the only oversight you have. Well, we have to have the same attitude toward the House and the Senate. From the population, we're the ones watching you, and are you doing your job?
Right. Well, Rachel, you're in the thick of things nationwide and internationally. Do you want to say anything too on this important thing about the, you know, if you talk about looking at the future, looking at the past, but from the point of view of the future, the two-party system is really a has-been now. But what do you want to say, Rachel?
Yeah, we have to get patriots together to unite around the principles of the nation, and parties really don't mean much anymore. I think everyone can see that. And as you brought up with this 11 senator letter, the party lines are being broken down. I mean, you're also getting a lot of Democrats criticizing Obama in other ways. I mean, our press conference in December, sponsored by Walter Jones, included a Democrat, Charlie Rangel. You had Alcee Hastings, an African-American senior legislator, cursing out Obama publicly. So all of those lines are being broken down, and that is what is another expression of this potential that you're bringing up right now for a complete change that can happen at any time, where you can get a breakout on Glass-Steagall and on impeachment at any moment. I think all we can expect right now is to expect the unexpected.
Yeah, that's right. It's dangerous, exciting, and it's what we're going to do, what we're about. You're quite right. Mention a couple of these things more. Alcee Hastings, yeah, now he's from Florida, and he was very tough about the behavior of the Obama administration in there and the campaign. Right? Do you know more about it, or do you want to say?
He was, if I recall, was one of the people who said, particularly with reference to blacks, right, that he hasn't done anything.
No.
Yeah.
He put all his money in big white media.
Yeah.
He stiffed black media.
He hasn't done anything for black people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, many blacks sort of reflexively defend him. For what?
And I... You know, and Rachel, it's good you mentioned these different things. I think Representative Conyers, certainly a very senior, I think he has had bills against...
The drone strikes.
Yeah, is that right?
Disclosure, yes.
What's he had?
Conyers
from Detroit, people know him.
And Dennis Kucinich, who's okay. No longer there, but was from Northern Ohio, have both put in a number of bills on drone strikes, calling for accountability by the administration. They've been killed by the leadership. But you've got a handful of people who've been trying to do the right thing in this. We just need many, many more. They show that it can be done, that people can stand up and do these things. And if they don't, I mean, ultimately, it probably will come down to the courts, but we don't have time. The courts move very slowly. We don't have time to wait for that. One of the most outrageous things in this memo that came out, this white paper.
Wait, that's the one that was...
This was the one that was...
The White House made one available because it was too hot or too leaked?
Well, there was so much pressure, and it had been... I mean, it already had been given to the senators and the Intelligence Committee. People had seen it before.
That's from last year on drones.
It was from last summer.
Killer drones.
Yeah,
okay.
It's sort of a redacted, sanitized version of the legal memos, 16 pages.
Okay.
They had it already, but it was leaked to NBC on Monday night and caused a firestorm because now it was public. Because see what happens with these things when they're given to when these classified or secret memos are given to the Intelligence Committee or other senators, they can't discuss them in public. This is why there wasn't any questioning about the Office of Legal Counsel memo in the Brennan hearing, because they have this, they can't discuss it, they can't ask questions about it in the hearing, they can't show it to their staff, right? In this case, even the Judiciary Committee didn't get it, only the Intelligence Committee. So there's real nasty games going on, but the fact of the white paper, that really created a different kind of climate for the Brennan hearing. But what I was saying is one of the points in this is they say there's no role for the courts. There's no role for the judiciary. This is non-reviewable. The president's action and the senior informed, you know, official, high-level official who decides who can be killed, there's no role for the courts in this. Now, people have short memories, but this was precisely the argument made by Cheney and Bush over interrogation policy and detention policy was... The courts can't do this. This is my commander-in-chief power as president. I'm defending the nation. Courts aren't in a position to decide these things. Well, three occasions at least, the Supreme Court came down and said, you're wrong. We do have a voice in this. This was particularly around the Guantanamo detentions. And so in 2004, 2006, and again in, I think, 2009, the question of does someone who's detained have the right to challenge their detention, the right of habeas corpus, right? And they said, we're not going to tell you exactly how to do it, but you have to give people this right. You can't hold someone indefinitely without giving them a chance to challenge their detention. And so it was the identical argument Obama's made, but Obama's saying it's not a question of detaining someone. It's a question of killing them.
Right, and they've issued imminent
courts,
threat.
Shut up, courts, judges. Okay. We're not listening to you. You have no role in this. So eventually, you know, what goes around will come around. But we don't have time to wait years and years for the Supreme Court to do these things. We have to move a lot faster.
Right. Well, let me ask you, I mean, we only have a few minutes, but Ed, we're dealing, whether you want to call it unitary executive or the principle of the Hitler dictatorship, that's what we're dealing with.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as we identified going back to the beginning of the Bush administration with Bush and Cheney, that this was precisely modeled on the powers that Hitler claimed, which had been cleaned up and now called the unitary executive. But it was the same idea, that the courts have no role, the parliament, the legislative branch have no role. In an emergency, this is the Carl Schmitt principle. In an emergency,
he was the jurist for Hitler.
Yeah, the crown, called Hitler's crown jurist.
Okay.
Around him in law schools and legal circles in the U.S. But the notion is, in an emergency, we can take emergency action, and it's unfettered, it's uncontrolled. We're not accountable to the judiciary, we're not accountable to the legislature. This is exactly what Bush and Cheney did, and what Obama's doing now. And as I was saying, it's particularly important to Democrats, who were outraged over Bush and Cheney properly, are equally outraged, should be more outraged, over what Obama's doing, because what Obama's doing, in fact, is worse.
Right. Well, I think that's it shows the character of what we're up against in some specifics about running killer drones, killing over 3,000 people, having 350 sorties. You know, I mean, it's just it's self-evident. So it takes us back to who we are, what kind of mind, what the morality involved in creative thinking, being human. So, Rachel, I guess we only have a couple of minutes, but you were appealing to people by reiterating people should be patriots, right, on principles. And in that sense, you've often said, why stand by as if we're just going to be an observer outside the universe of what you often call trend rates of collapse? You know what I mean? Like, just watch everything go down. Instead, we're called upon to intervene. Do you want to say anything in closing about the activation? We mentioned Congress, but we're not lobbying as usual. That's the last thing we're doing. Okay.
We've been getting a lot of meetings in Congress and changes happening because people are joining with us to take part in this process. We do know what will happen without a Glass-Steagall policy. I think we can't really emphasize enough thinking through this process of the credit system and the transformation to the credit system.
Mm-hmm.
As LaRouche emphasized in the webcast last night, or educating yourself on what that change is so that you can take people at the state legislator level or congressional level through what that process will be, because a lot of them don't know. That is one thing that is clear about Congress, is frankly they don't understand the economic collapse. They really don't understand the difference between a monetarist policy and a real credit policy. So it's our role, and everyone who's listening to this, to really think through this process so that we can educate others on it.
Oh, that's absolutely. You can certainly see that, and especially with 3 feet of snow. Let's get physical production. Make these the buzzwords, what we ought to be doing. Well, I want to thank you very much. I'm so glad you could be on again. Rachel Brown from Boston, and good to have Ed Spanis. So this will conclude February 9th, 2013, The LaRouche Show. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm.